And now back to Diet Coke's presentation of the Lost Lennon Tapes. Once again, here's your host and guide, Elliot Mintz.
I'm standing here on Bank Street in New York's Greenwich Village, right outside the apartment John and Yoko were living in when they first established a base here. At the time, I was doing a local radio program in Los Angeles, had done a few interviews with Yoko, and she was kind enough to set up an interview with John. This was the very first time John and I had ever spoken. It was October 10th, 1971, a day after his 31st birthday, and I started our telephone conversation by asking him what he thought about growing old.
First thing I think of is Yoko and I as a nice old couple, right, off the coast of Ireland or something like that.
Right.
Or in Cornwall or whatever it is. That's the initial dream. And I don't have any fear of age. I'm sort of looking forward to it, you know. I sort of think, well, maybe I won't be so frantic when I'm older, or, you know, both of us will be less frantic, or, you know, we'll be taking life easier. I like thinking what I might be doing then. And I certainly don't wish I was any younger, because I don't know, about 30, 31, and I suppose, you know, for quite a, I don't know how long, 10, 15 years, maybe more, it's, you are less frantic than you are when you're 20 or 18, or certainly I am anyway, and so it's just a nice age, you know. I mean, my auntie Mimi used to always say to me, you know, 30 is the right age for a man, all that shit, and I thought she was just giving me a lot of bull, you know. But in a way she was right, you know, it was like an old wives' tale, and it's a good age because you're sort of, you're not old, and you sort of had some experience, and like she used to say, you've become a man of the world, right? I mean, you don't have to travel the world to do that, but that's what she was talking about. It's amazing how true it seem to be. Now I think I'm the happiest I've ever been. I have Yoko, and that's all that really matters to me. And I feel as though if I'd been or done anything else, I would not have met her, you know, because I had to be just me at the right time, at the right moment, meeting her, right?
Yes.
And so all the sort of pain and whatever life entails for all of us seems to have made that worthwhile. Although, even before meeting her, I didn't feel as though life wasn't worth living. But now, it certainly is the most most happy period of my life, so I don't really regret anything. Although I would have liked to have a normal childhood and things like that, but maybe I wouldn't have met Yoko, right, if that had been the way. So that's what I think about it.
This is karma, it's gonna get you. Gonna knock you right on the head.
You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're gonna be dead.
John, there were a couple of questions that I've always wanted to ask you.
Yes.
One of them, if you were a draft-age American male,
yes,
2 or 3 years ago, living in the United States,
yes,
would you have gone to Vietnam, gone to jail, or left the country?
I think I probably would have left the country. I couldn't really guess. You see, when I was a youngster, just around about 16, they still had draft in England, I think. They didn't go till I was about 15, 16, something, just, you know, a couple of years before I was eligible.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any money, so I wasn't sure how to do it, you know. But I always had the idea of going to Southern Ireland, you know, for a start. I probably would have ended up in Dublin and then Paris and then probably New York, you know, if it had happened in England. I would not have gone, no.
You definitely would not.
No, no.
You once called radio station KPFK in Berkeley during the People's Parcastle.
Yeah.
And at that time you said that you didn't believe there was any cause worth dying for. Do you still believe that?
I'm not sure. I don't think I can anymore, although I'd like to. And but I really believe in, after what's happened, especially, you know, it's everywhere, I really think of defensive violence is, you know, okay.
Defensive violence?
When you're attacked, you have to defend yourself, right?
Like the thing you were talking about on the Cabot Show.
Yeah, I think, well, I remember, I don't know, you know, whether I've got it exactly right. I remember reading some Black Panther 10-point program or something. You know, I'm not a great reader of all those sort of things that's going on.
I remember you speaking
about... I think they say it very well. Although I don't know how people interpreted it to sort of start killing them all off. But I think they said it very well, didn't they, in the original thing.
I remember you mentioning that on the Cabot Show. So in other words, you do believe that under certain conditions it's all right to take somebody else's life.
Well, I don't know. I hate to even admit it in my own head, but when I see people on the streets of Northern Ireland on TV, just sort of getting killed and that, I think they should defend themselves, yeah. There's nothing else for them to do.
Power to the people. John, is there anything that you have ever wanted to say in a public interview that's never been asked of you? Any comment that you wanted to always get out that when you read the thing later or heard it on the radio or saw it on TV, said, gee, I just wish you would have asked me this, or I just wanted to say one thing.
Well, one thing I've always wanted to say.
Back of the city, old tape under the city, somebody want to buy a fucking pit of tunnel.
Something like that.
Yes, I can understand.
I got that off my chest.
John, I must tell you that this has been such a joy for us talking.
It's a pleasure.
And I also have to add that having collected everything that you've ever recorded from day one, Imagine has to be my favorite song in the world, and the album has to be not only your best, but no doubt one of the most tasteful albums to be released this year anywhere. It's just such a beautiful experience to go with you on your visions and your journeys.
That's very kind of you. That's beautiful, you know, and I don't know what to say. I'm glad you like it. I like Imagine, the song myself, because I think it's like a child song.
It's a pure fantasy, yeah.
Yeah, I wrote it. It came, the idea came like a child's song, you know, and I wanted to keep it so a child could understand it.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
The song that captivated the world in 1971, and still does. The entire Imagine album was recorded in the summer of that year, and as he made it, John saved the tapes of alternate versions and some unusual arrangements. We found those tapes, and you'll be hearing them in the weeks to come as this series unfolds.
There's lots more to come. In a moment, John talks about a Beatles reunion, Paul, and male chauvinism. It's the Lost Lennon Tapes on the Westwood One Radio Network. Now, back to the Lost Lennon Tapes. Here's your host, John's close friend and confidant, Elliot Mintz.
Right now, I'm standing in front of a bungalow here at the Beverly Hills Hotel. This was one of the bungalows that John and Yoko liked to stay in when they visited Los Angeles. It also was a place that gave me an opportunity to do one of our very extensive 4 or 5 hour interviews. It was April of 1973. A month earlier, American immigration authorities had issued an order to deport John because of an old drug bust in England. John filed an appeal. But there were other stories in the papers about him, too. Earlier that week, there had been a Beatles reunion of sorts when John and George sat in on one of Ringo's recording sessions. Word got out, and the music business was filled with rumors of a dream concert or album. So the first thing I asked John when I walked through this door in this hotel that day was whether he thought the band would ever get back together.
I hate to say never, 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 because, you know, it's just sort of negative, but I honestly, in my heart of hearts, don't ever, ever see wanting to do that again in any form whatsoever. And just to be rational about it, if you think of when the Beatles were together at the end, or even at their heyday, you know, but at the end as well, it wasn't like everybody was saying, aren't they wonderful, and every single we put out sold a million or whatever it was. Some did better than others, and some albums did better than others. And it wasn't heaven, right? I mean, in that respect, like everybody's...
That's number one.
Well, there were a lot of them, I'd be, a lot of them, but not that many. I mean, enough, you know. But I mean, it wasn't like, it's all in people's heads now. It's 10 years or whatever since it all happened. And you can imagine if we got together, well, you just look at the Birds.
Mm.
They got together for that album, big hullabaloo, they've split again. Apparently, I didn't hear the album, so I don't know, but everybody knocked it in the reviews as far as I can gather. And it's exactly what would happen to the Beatles. Everybody would say it's not good enough because they'll have this wonderful dream of how it was. And it'll never be like that because it never was like everybody thinks it was. It was wonderful and it's over.
There's one name that has not come up in our discussion.
Who's that?
Polly.
Yes, he did. We said Paul on it. I object to that Polly business.
Mr. McCartney, his name only...
Paul.
Paul, yes. And we really haven't discussed him to any degree, and people are always concerned about how you regard him.
I first met Paul.
No, they're not interested in that aspect, but they are interested in how you relate to him now. There is this all-pervasive feeling, you know, that folks sometimes articulate that you don't have the fondest of feelings towards him. Perhaps you'd like to discuss that.
Well, because of the situation we're in, and I often express myself through song, or mainly through song. Somebody else can have, let's call it, say he was a brother of mine in the family. Now, if two brothers argue and fight for whatever reason, or even write, and the only way they express themselves, because they're not artists, is through either through letters or through dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
One brother goes away to sea, not because they had a fight, because he's going away to sea anyway. The last thing they did was have an argument. The brother away at sea, let's call that me, because I went to America, say, might write to his brother, or he might write to his other relative, auntie, and say, you know, Charlie said this, and, you know, whatever you might say about it. Now, because we're in the... We do it on the grand scale or whatever the trip is we're on, that my letters home are examined and taken for a lifelong statement. Now, I said, I want to hold your hand when that's what I was saying then. At the same time, I was saying, it grubble on the diddle foes in my books, right? So, yeah, okay, so I said it, right? So, well, what does it mean? Does it mean that that is the Bible, and I, when I'm 80, that's what I mean? And I'll reiterate yet again, because I heard the program, you know, Do They, Will They, Are They, about the song How Do You Sleep? Now I'll say it once again. How Do You Sleep was my reaction to Paul's first album, and the song that particularly offended not only me, but the others too. And maybe we were super paranoid at the time, but that's irrelevant. It's there in green and white. Was Too Many People and some various other remarks. Now, whether he was expressing himself, because whether we plan it to express our innermost feelings or sort of surreal it like Dylan or Paul, you could say his lyrics are very sort of non-specific. If one knows the person, one knows what is coming down. You know, you can read what's being
between
said
the
between the lines. And that was what it was all about. And I don't go around thinking, how do you sleep? The same as I don't go around thinking, imagine there's no heaven, you know, because it's 1973 now and it's a different world.
Personally feel, John, that you have come to grips with whatever remaining conscious chauvinism you may have had in you since your association with Yoko? I mean, do you still consciously work at getting rid of some of the old stereotype trips, or is it gone for the most part?
It's no. Well, that's for Yoko to judge. You know, I'm like she says in her song, he's doing the best that he can. Mm-hmm. Me and all men, whatever state of consciousness they're in. My main education, apart from creatively from Yoko, has been racism. Education as much as of the experience of being with her, because we're an intermarried, interracial couple. Mm-hmm. Which, although we didn't realize at the time, has a lot of side effects, and a lot of people don't realize that. Racism and chauvinism. Now, the racism was an eye-opener for me, although I considered myself liberal and whatever it was, you know, and understood these problems, but having lived it, it's a different ball game altogether. And the chauvinism was a real eye-opener, because I didn't realize what a pig I was. You know, I mean, one doesn't realize until somebody tells you, mm-hmm. you know. And another thing about relationships is they always say, you know, the bloom wears off and all that jazz. Now, it was wonderful to be sort of in the rosy bloom of first love, and it was really an experience, but it's much better now. It's true. So much, and it's getting better. It doesn't get worse. Really, see, they program you to say that, you know, after a few years, you're going to be sick of it, and you're going to be wanting something else, you know? But if you have a relationship with somebody, you don't want something else. You don't want to move on, you know, and you don't get bored, because then you establish, you get to know the person in ways that you could never possibly know just loving each other over the romantic roses on the table, which is beautiful. And it's entirely different. It grows.
Woman is the leader of the world. Yes, she is. Think about it. Something about it. We make her paint her face and dance. If she won't be a slave and say that she don't love. If she's real, we say she's trying to be a man. While putting her down, we pretend that she's above us.
has no guts or confidence. When she's young, we kill her will to be free. Why tell her not to be so smart? We put her down for being so dumb.
One of several John Lennon songs that was both controversial and widely misunderstood. In this three-hour introduction to our series, we're only able to scratch the surface to give you an idea of what's in the hundreds of hours that comprise the Lost Lennon tapes. Among those treasures are reels of John's home recordings during the 70s, those days when he would just sit down here in the Dakota with his guitar and a tape recorder and play. A taste of John's home recordings we'll be exploring in the weeks to come as our journey through the Lost Lennon tapes continues on the Westwood One radio network.
And now back to the Lost Lennon tapes. Once again, your host, Elliot Mintz.
I'm sitting in the white room of the Dakota, the white room being the living room. I guess Yoko calls it the white room because it is, as you guessed, a very white room. White walls and thick, deep, white pile carpeting. Shibui, as the Japanese call it. The piano that I'm sitting next to is the piano upon which John composed Imagine. This was the room that historically, traditionally, every Christmas and New Year's, John and Yoko and myself would sit around and reminisce about times past. 1975 was a particularly wonderful New Year's Eve for us because 1975 was the year John and Yoko had gotten together again after a separation where John went to Los Angeles. He called it the Lost Weekend. Much has been written and said about that period of time, including an experience at a local Los Angeles club called the Troubadour, where John and Harry Nilsson were thrown out for being drunk and unruly. So on January 1st, 1976, in this very room, I turned to John, and I asked him to reminisce about that particular experience.
The Troubadour was one of the great moments of my life, and when they write it in the little silly books of Hollywood that'll finally be written, that'll be one of the little events, like Errol Flynn bit Frank Sinatra's mother at the party. I mean, it was a great night, actually. And it's unimportant only to the people that think it's important. I mean, there were some good moments, you know. And it's just that actually a friend called me yesterday, and he's just split with his woman. And I said, although I didn't do it myself, when Yoko and I were apart, she did like a spiritual trip, and his girlfriend is doing a spiritual trip, and he's liable to hit the bottle like I did, you know? And I said, if you can possibly be strong enough, spiritual chip's better, because when we got back together, Yoko's in far better condition than me. You come to the same conclusion. All roads lead to Rome, but it's a hell of a way, you know, crawling around your hands and knees in the middle of the night, you know? And so that was the advice I gave him, and he called yesterday, and I hope he takes it. He probably won't. He'll probably have to go the hard way, because he's male, you know, and we express ourselves in those ways and violence and all that. And that's how I feel about it. I've been through it. It's unimportant. It's over.
You really went through it. I mean, it became almost legendary. The past year with the drinking, with the Spectre session, with Harry Nielsen, with... Yeah. It just goes on and on forever and ever. Do you look back
at... I just wanted to show the boys that if they want to know how to get really down with it, I can get further. You know, I'm an extremist, right?
But you bounce...
I mean, if they want to play Hard Knocks, we go right through the wall, you see.
Could you recall...
Macho crap.
Could you recall, like, a composite picture of an evening during that you could reveal to the people that would give them an idea of what it was like when you were down and out in Hollywood in 1975?
I wasn't down and out, Elliot. I was down and up.
Could you...
No, I couldn't do that. I mean, look, I mean, we had the same kind of nights in Liverpool before we ever made it. It's just that when you're famous, they put you in the paper when you tie one on, as you call it. You know, you get in the paper when you're famous, and you're not, if you're just some guy in Idaho goes out with the boys and, you know, breaks a few telephone booths or something, nobody writes about it. You either get arrested or you don't, you know. That's, it's exactly the same as anybody else does it, only we do it with red carpets in front of us.
You ever get bored of all of this stuff, I mean, of being John Lennon, of being John and Yoko, the constant attention, the constant, the fame, the accoutrements that it causes. You ever just wish you could be anonymous, put the ski mask over your head, blend into the crowd, and act independently from everybody else without the whole world being interested in your business, without people like me prying and turning up these things, asking questions? Would it be good if all of this was just not there?
Well, I don't know, you know. I mean, I do get bored with it or frustrated with being the famous one or one of the famous ones. But then I did it myself, you know. I can't blame anybody else for the situation. I mean, I did it. You know? And I vaguely remember not being famous, as it were. And it was no easier or harder, actually.
It wasn't?
Not much, you know. Sometimes I'd like to be invisible, you know. But maybe I don't try hard enough.
Try harder at being invisible?
Yeah. You know, maybe in the back I'm really still, you know, like the glamour. You know, I do enjoy being famous too. Sometimes it's great, you know, whoopee, you know. Other times it's a pain in the neck. But I guess everybody's life is like that, you know. That's what I keep saying, there's no secret. You know, it doesn't, you know, the only, you know, if you haven't got any food and you're starving or you're ill and you can't pay for the doctor, then it's bad. But anything above that, you know, one car or 12, it's pretty much the same.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. No, I won't be afraid. As you stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Love, stand by me. Stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon,
question is always the same question as it is whenever we end an interview or a discussion about Beatle business. And when I last spoke with you on film and television, I asked you, what do you think the chances would ever be of the reunion? And you said to me, I really couldn't say. And then I said to you, what if you really could say? And then you said, I don't know. And I said, but if you did know, and you said, quote, I don't know, Elliot, it doesn't make that much difference to me, but the wounds have all been healed, and if somebody called me up and said, let's do it again, maybe I do it again. The most important thing is that we just go ahead and make music, unquote. January 1st, 1976. Would you like not to go on tour, not to be the Beatles again, not to make records and lunchboxes and craziness, but how about one glorious night, the big reunion, the closed-circuit reunion in every movie theater in the world, the Beatles back again?
There's obviously people have talked about that. That to me is not interesting because it would only be done for more cash. You might have noticed that I haven't performed for cash since the Beatles stopped. I don't particularly like touring. I don't want to play for money. I'll take the money for making a record because it keeps me in the condition to which I'm accustomed. But I'm not interested in standing on stage and have people give me dollars, you know? And if that was the reason for the Beatles getting together, I'd have to be broke or owe a lot of tax, you know? And then I'd get up and do the bit with the clown's face and run around, you know? Otherwise, it gives me a chill just thinking of it.
Let me approach you from a different door.
Come in, my dear.
What if it was the four reunited for one night for benefit, for $10 million going to some charity or some organization or a concern?
The trouble with charities is they're not very charitable, you know. It's much more complicated than you think. I don't know. I mean, it really never enters my head for the four Beatles to play together. And like I said in that interview to you, it's feasible that we could play in a studio just for the sake of playing with somebody who knows, you know, who's played with you for years, you know. But apart from that, there doesn't seem to be any point to it, you know, unless it was going to, somebody would guarantee it would save the planet Earth, you know, then give me a call.
Got to do one more follow-up question on this because it's the one that...
When the Martians get in touch with us, then the Beatles will do a concert.
I forget about the concert for a minute. What if one of them...
But cancel that. It might happen.
Thank you.
thank you again for talking with us on 1976 New Year's Eve.
Yeah, Happy New Year, everyone, wherever you may be.
And now, if we could just have a verse of As Time Goes By.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A fly is just a fly.
John Lennon with Elliot Mintz on New Year's Day, 1976. More of the Lost Lennon tapes in a moment.
The years that followed my 1976 interview with John have been called his reclusive years. In fact, he had decided to refocus his attention away from music and concentrate on himself, Yoko, and their son Sean. It wasn't until 1980 that John decided to record again. The result was an album called Double Fantasy, and a taped record of its creation, unique in the history of rock and roll. All that and more in a moment when we continue our journey through the Lost Lennon tapes on the Westwood One Radio Network.